At the same time, he was assessing the contact. Obviously, the gang had been taken as unaware as they were. They had not been able to prepare any kind of defence, nor had the time to set up an ambush. Probably they had heard the roar of the approaching helicopter, and then only seconds later, the scouts had begun dropping amongst them. Surprise, Sean thought, and shot at the muzzle flashes of an AK that were fluttering the leaves of a thorn bush only 30 paces ahead. From experience, he had learnt that the Shona guerrillas facing him were first-class soldiers, doughty and brave and dedicated. They had two weaknesses, however. First, their fire control was poor. They believed that sheer weight of fire made up for inaccuracy. Their other weakness was the inability to react swiftly to surprise. Sean knew that for another minute or so, the terrorists in the scrub in front of him would be disorganized and flustered. Hit them now, he thought, and snatched a phosphorus grenade from his webbing. As he pulled the pin from the grenade, he opened his mouth to yell at Roland Ballantyne. Come on, Roland, sweep the line, charge the sods before they settle down. Roland beat him to it. The same thoughts must have raced through his mind. Take them, boys, sweep the line, on the charge. Sean leapt to his feet, and in the same movement hurled the grenade in a high, arcing trajectory. It fell 30 yards ahead of him, and the thorn scrub erupted in a blinding white cloud of phosphorus smoke. Flaming fragments, burning with a dazzling white radiance, showered over the area. Sean raced forward, conscious of the small dark shape that ran at his heels. Mutatu was his shadow. Other grenades were exploding across the front, and the thorn scrub was thrashed by the blasts and lashed by the sheets of automatic fire that the scouts threw down as they charged. The gang broke before them. One of them ducked out of the bush 10 paces ahead. A teenager in tattered blue jeans and a soft camouflage cap. Burning globules of phosphorus had adhered to his upper body. They sizzled and flared, leaving smoking black spots on his arms and torso. The smoke smelt like barbecuing meat. Sean shot him, but the burst was low. It broke his left hip, and the boy dropped. The AK rifle flew from his grip, and he rolled onto his back and held his hands in front of his face. No, Mambu, he screamed in English. Do not kill me. I am a Christian. For the love of God, spare me. Mutatu, Sean snapped without checking or looking round. Kufa! He jumped over the maimed guerrilla. The magazine of his FN was half empty. He could not afford to waste a single round, and Mutatu had his skinning knife. He spent hours each day honing the blade. If he had been a section leader, Sean might have saved him for interrogation, but Mutatu could cut this one's throat. Cannon fodder like him was of no use to them, and medical attention was expensive. The scouts swept the bush, and it was over in less than 2 minutes. It was no contest. It was like pitting Pekingese puppies against a pack of wild dogs. The scouts charged through and then whirled and came back. Secure the area, Roland Ballantyne ordered. He was standing less than 20 yards from Sean. He held the muzzle of his rifle pointed to the sky, and the heated metal distorted the air around it in a watery mirage. Well done, Sean, that little black devil of yours is a charm. He glanced across at Mutatu. Mutatu was straightening up from the corpse of the hip-shot terrorist. He had slit his throat with a single stroke across the side of his throat and up under the ear to catch the carotid artery. He was wiping the blade of his skinning knife on his thigh as he scurried back to his rightful place at Sean's side, but he grinned an acknowledgement at Roland Ballantyne. Both of them were distracted, still heady with the euphoria of violence and blood. The corpse of one of the other guerrillas lay in the scrub between them. The flesh and clothing still smouldered with burnt-out phosphorus, and the man's clothing was splattered with bright blood from his gunshot wounds. Roland Ballantyne walked past him with barely a glance. It was impossible that the terrorist could have survived such terrible injuries. The terrorist rolled over abruptly. He had been concealing a Tokarev pistol under his shattered chest. With his last flutter of life, he lifted the Tokarev, and he was close enough to touch Roland with the muzzle. Roland! Sean screamed a warning. And although Roland reacted instantly, it was too late. The shot would take him in the spine from a range of 3 feet. Sean did not have time to raise the FN to his shoulder. He fired from the hip, pointing and aiming instinctively. The bullet caught the terrorist in the face. His head burst like an overripe watermelon hit with a pick-handle, and he flopped over on his back. The Tukarev slipped unfired from his nerveless fingers. Roland Ballantyne straightened up slowly, and for a long moment he stared down at the corpse. The man's legs were kicking and trembling convulsively. Roland contemplated his own mortality and saw the agony of his own death reflected in the man's bulging eyeballs. He tore his gaze away and looked across at Sean. "I owe you one," he said curtly. "You can collect any time." And he turned away to shout orders at his scouts to gather the kill. There were green plastic body bags in the hovering alouette. Lamorn Brabant was a jagged mountain of black volcanic lava that seemed to tower over them threateningly, even though they were almost 4 miles out on the oceanic stream. These sapphire currents that eddied around the toe of the island of Mauritius created an enrichment of marine life that big-game anglers around the world recognized as a hot spot. There were other famous grounds, such as those off the ribbons of the Great Barrier Reef, at Cabo San Lucas on the Californian Peninsula, or in the lee of the island of Nova Scotia. At all these points, the concentrations of vast shoals of baitfish attracted the ocean predators, the giant marlin and the tuna species. The sports anglers of the world came to pit their skill and their strength against these sleek monsters. Shaza Courtney always insisted on chartering the same boat and the same island crew. Each boat sets up its own individual vibration in the water, a combination of engine and propeller and hull configuration, which is as unique to that boat as a fingerprint is to the man. That vibration either attracts or repels fish. La Bonheur was a lucky boat. She pulled fish, and her skipper had eyes like a gannet. He could spot the flash of a single seabird diving on a school of baitfish on the horizon, or at a mile's distance, pick out the sickle-shaped dorsal fin of a cruising marlin and estimate the fish's weight to within 10 kilos. Today, however, they were desperate for bait. They had been out for almost 2 hours without putting a bait on the outriggers. Everywhere they looked, there were shoals of baitfish. The Indian Ocean seemed to swarm with their multitudes. They darkened the surface of the water like patches of cloud shadow, and dense flocks of seabirds circled over them, screaming and diving in avaricious hysteria. Every few minutes a volley of leaping bonito would burst through the surface and arc in glittering silver parabolas through the brilliant tropical sunshine. They were being panicked and driven up by the great pelagic fish that circled in the depths below the shoals. It was one of those crazy days that occur all too seldom in a fisherman's life, when there are simply too many fish. The ravenous predators were harrying the shoals so viciously that they were unable to feed. All their energy was diverted to avoiding the voracious charging monsters that tore through the shoals. They ignored the small finger-length feather allures with which the crew of La Bonheur were trying to tempt them. Standing on the flying bridge 15 feet above the deck, Shaza could see into the limpid blue waters. He could clearly make out the hordes of bonito, like fat cigars as long as his forearm, dodging and ducking through La Bonheur's wake. They almost touched the feather jigs as they darted past them. "Oh, we need one, just one bait," Shaza groaned. "On a day like this, it's an ironclad guarantee of a marlin." Elsa Pignatelli leaned over the bridge rail beside him. She wore only a tiny, flaming, scarlet bikini, and she was tanned and smooth as a loaf of honey bread crisp from the oven. "Look," she cried, and Shaza whirled just in time to see a marlin come out of the water alongside La Bonheur. It was driven high into the air by the speed and power of its own charge, as it split a shoal of bonito. Its eyes were the size of tennis balls, and its spike was the length and thickness of a baseball bat. The water streamed from its flanks in silver cascades, and it wagged its great head in the air. In the excitement of the feeding frenzy, it had changed colour, like a chameleon, and burnt with the bands of electric blue and lilac that turned the tropical blue of the sky pale in contrast. "A grander!" Shaza shouted the colloquial name for a fish that would push the scale beyond the mystic 1,000-pound mark. The Marlin fell back and hit the water flat on its side, with a report like a shot of cannon. "A bait!" cried Sharsa, clutching his brow like a Shakespearean tragedian. "My kingdom for a bait!" The other half-dozen boats of the Black River fleet, that they could see scattered to the horizon, were suffering the same agonies. They could hear the frustrated lamentations of their skippers on the ship's radio. Nobody had bait. While out there, the Marlin were waiting to commit suicide. "What can I do?" Elsa demanded. "Do you want me to propound a little of my witchcraft and weave a spell for you?" "I don't know if that would be strictly ethical," Sharsa grinned back at her. "But I'm willing to try anything. Weave away, my lovely witch." She opened her purse and found her lipstick. "Tom Thumb, Thomas a Becket, Rumpelstiltskin," she intoned solemnly, and drew a scarlet hieroglyph on his naked chest, which had a distinctly phallic outline. "I diddle you, I fiddle you, I doddle you, I doodle you." "Oh yes, I love it," Sharsa laughed out loud. "I could get seriously hooked on your type of magic."
"You have to believe in it," she warned him, "or else it just won't work."
"Oh, I believe," said Sharsa fervently. "Oh, how I believe in doodling you." Down on the deck below them, one of the crew squealed suddenly, and they heard the tinny whir of the ratchet on one of the small bait rods. Sharsa's laughter was cut off abruptly. For an instant he stared at her with awe. "Damn me, you really are a witch," he muttered. And he dived for the ladder and slid down to the deck. The deckhand brought the skipjack Bonito over the side, and cradled him lovingly in his arms. The fish quivered and struggled, but he cushioned its fat round body against his chest. It was a pretty metallic blue and silver, with a pointed snout and sharp-bladed tail fins. Its lower body was laced with lateral lines of black. Sharsa saw with relief that it was lightly hooked in the hinge of the jaw. There was no damage to its gills. He slipped the small hook from its jaw and ordered the deckie, "Turn him!" The deckie inverted the Bonito, and immediately its struggles ceased. Holding it upside down was a trick that disorientated and quietened it. Sharsa had his bait instruments laid out like those of a surgeon. He selected the long crochet hook and worked it carefully into the front of the Bonito's eye socket. The blunt steel tip pushed the eyeball aside and did not damage it in the least. He steered the needle into the natural canal through the bone of the fish's skull. The tip emerged from the same spot in the opposite eye socket. The fish showed no sign of distress and lay quietly in the deckie's arms. Sharsa hooked a loop of 120-pound Dacron line over the steel crochet hook and gently drew the line back through the wound. He dropped the crochet hook and snatched up the huge 12-0 Marlin hook. With a series of quick, deft turns, he had attached the hook firmly between the Bonito's eyes. The fish was still alive and virtually unharmed. Its eyesight was unimpaired. Sharsa stood back and nodded to the deckie. He knelt on the gunwale and lowered the Bonito over the side, solicitous as a nursemaid. As soon as it was released, the fish darted away, drawing the heavy steel trace and the attached Dacron line behind it. It disappeared almost instantly into the blue depths. Sharsa stood beside the fighting chair. The stubby rod was set in the gimbal. The Finnor Tycoon reel was made of gold-anodized marine-grade aluminium alloy. Still, it weighed over 5 kilos and held over 1 kilometer of the braided Dacron line. The line hissed softly as it streamed off the reel. Sharsa adjusted the tension on it with a light touch of his fingertips. He had marked the line with wraps of silk thread at intervals of 50 yards. He let out a measured 100 yards before he tightened the drag lever of the reel. The deckie was already lowering the halyard of one of the 20-foot outriggers that protruded like whippy steel antennae from each side of the hull. The purpose of the outrigger was to hold the line separated and to allow the slack bight of line to drop back when the Marlin struck. "No," Sharsa stopped him. "I'll hold it myself."